man with a turban on head, on turban on fire. And I bring this up just to point that here, this is one of many passages where the Buddha is not talking about mindfulness as being abroad, accepting whatever arises. That mindfulness is part of this effort to get rid of the unskillful things. This connects with the third one. Just as a royal frontier fortress has a gatekeeper, wise, competent, intelligent, to keep out those he doesn't know and to let in those he does, for the protection of those within and to ward off those without. In the same way, a disciple of the noble ones is mindful, endowed with excellent proficiency in mindfulness, remembering and able to call to mind even things that were done and said long ago. Now, if you're alert, you realize that it's a slightly different translation of the same passage. With mindfulness as his gatekeeper, the disciple of the noble ones abandons what is unskillful, develops what is skillful, abandons what is blameworthy, develops what is blameless, and looks after himself with purity. Okay, that gatekeeper, mindfulness, has to know who you let in and who you don't let in. It has to be very careful about skillful qualities. You know, you don't want the spies to come in. You don't want anybody who's going to undo your fortress to come in. So the role of mindfulness here is to remember, okay, who's trustworthy and who's not. And then if it's something that's not trustworthy, you keep it out. I was reading a book a while back where a monk who was writing about this, who was advancing the idea that mindfulness just is, bare awareness and open acceptance, says, well, just the fact that you've got a gatekeeper there is going to keep all the enemy out. Kind of like the mannequins they have in police cars. You don't do that in Canada, do you? There are little towns that don't have enough to hire policemen in America. And so they park a car by the side of the road and they put a mannequin with a police uniform. And it works the first time you drive past. The rest of that image is interesting, and the Buddha's talking about how you've got a frontier fortress. You need a sense of shame and a sense of compunction as your moat and encircling road. You need arms, which is your learning, the things that you've remembered, that you learned from the Dharma. You need a good, strong set of soldiers to fight off. That's your right effort. You need walls that are slippery so the enemy can't climb up. Guess what that's a symbol for? Discernment. In other words, you can't, your defilements can't grab hold of you. And then finally, you've got stores of food for your gatekeeper and your soldiers, and that's your concentration. So. Okay. Passage 4 is another one that talks about mindfulness really being an active principle. Okay, how is mindfulness the governing principle? The mindfulness that I will make complete any training with regard to good conduct that is not yet complete, or I will protect with discernment any training with regard to good conduct that is complete, is established right within. Okay, this, if it's not there yet, you are mindful to give rise to it, and when it's there, you're mindful to maintain it. So again, it's remembering that you've got duties that you've got to do. The mindfulness that I will make complete any training with regard to the basics of the holy life that is not yet complete, that's basically having to do with the five precepts. Or I'll protect with discernment any training with regard to the basics of the holy life that is complete, is well established right within. The mindfulness that I will scrutinize with discernment any dharma that is not yet scrutinized, or I will protect with discernment any dharma that has been scrutinized, is well established right within. Now that's your discernment faculty. Okay, if there's something you don't understand, you remind yourself, I've got to learn how to understand this. And if that discernment isn't there, you try to give rise to it. So mindfulness is basically directing you as to what's the appropriate thing to do. And finally, the mindfulness that I will touch through release any dharma that is not yet touched, or protect with discernment any dharma that has been touched, is well released right within. This deals with the development of concentration and finally to the final release. So again, your mindfulness here is not just being very aware of what's happening right now, but it's being aware, okay, there are certain duties that you have to keep in mind that you will apply to what's happening right now as well. Now, passage 5 is the one that has to do with the different stages of mindfulness practice. First, there's the establishing of mindfulness, which is the basic satipatthana definition that we've read several times now. Now, the development of the establishing of mindfulness is the case where you are focused on the phenomenon of origination, passing away, or both. And again, this is origination in the terms of what's giving rise to these things. Now, for example, with the aggregates, it's not just the fact that aggregates arise and pass away on their own. There has to be, as the Buddha says, an element of desire for any of these things to be experienced. Okay, where is the element of desire there? You've got to look for that. Then similarly with the others. What I forgot to add to this passage was where the Buddha says, how do you go about developing? That's what he calls this, the development of the establishing of mindfulness. And that's by developing all 8 factors of the path, which includes right concentration. Any questions on that? Yes. Oh, just go down and visit an old folks' home. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's all around. You go down to a hospital. Mm-hmm. In Thailand, they tend to be kind of slow in picking up victims of accidents off the road. And so, being over there, you got a lot of opportunity. Mm-hmm. But here, as I said, you know, hospitals, old folks' homes. Visit those. And notice, though, in that particular example that the Buddha gives, you're visualizing. He's not actually saying to go into the charnel grounds. I mean, you can visualize. You've probably seen enough. And do you ever watch horror movies? I always avoided them when I was a kid. I stayed away with them. But, you know, there's enough. I mean, no, I'm not advocating, but you just bring on up your memories. I mean, I was on a plane a while back, and they had this thing called World War Z. Did you see that one? It was just god awful. Fast zombies. This is something about our culture I don't understand. I mean, zombies. I just I don't know where this came from. But you've probably seen enough of, and you can take out an anatomy book. You know, then they have those, you know, the body exhibitions nowadays where they've had these plasticized corpses. You look at those. And that reminds you, okay, this body's going to be that way too. Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay, with discernment, you can't really make it happen. It's like you can create the causes and sort of put yourself in a position where you are more likely to gain an insight into something. Because a lot of discernment is seeing things you didn't expect. And that's learning how to look out the side of your eye. And so you've got to put yourself in a position, okay, where will I see interesting things out of the side of my eye? I mean, I know I'll give you an analogy. It's like being a hunter. They talk about how hunting is, of all the skills of the of the old cultures, the ones that anthropologists have the most trouble picking up. You know, there's that school of anthropology that if you really want to understand a culture, you have to go and learn the skills of the people in that culture. Like if they do pottery, you have to learn pottery. If they weave, if they, you know, do all these other things, you have to learn how to weave, you have to learn how to farm the way they did, if you're really going to understand that culture. And I've been told by one anthropologist that no anthropologist has learned how to hunt because it takes too much concentration. And so the principle of hunting is that you go to some place where you know the rabbits are likely to be there. You know, University of Victoria. And you have to be very quiet because you know that if the rabbits know you're there, they're not going to come out. But at the same time, you have to be very alert. You can't just doze off and the rabbits will go right past your nose. Now, once you've got yourself down there, you know, okay, you can't say, I'm going to get a rabbit by five so I can get it home by six so we can have dinner at seven. You know, okay, when the rabbits come, I'll ready for the rabbit. So you place yourself in the right place and you try to develop these qualities of stillness and alertness. And then wait for the rabbit to come. So that's the best analogy I can give. Yes.
When you said you are to discern the origin of something arising or becoming, and you said desire, you have a desire, is it the same as intention?
Well, every desire has some sort of intention behind it. And the Buddha talks about how, you know, when you experience a feeling, there's the potential for the feeling that's coming in from your past karma, and then there's the intention right now to experience it as a feeling. And it's the two of those together that give rise to the experience.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I'm asking, like, you walk in meditation again in the traditions that I've been with, after a while you are asked to observe your intention.
Mm-hmm.
Like intending to live.
Mm-hmm.
So, are you talking about that or not? Is it comfortable?
Well, you try to get into that habit of watching your intention, not only in obvious movements like this, but you begin to look at what's your intention in your mind, because that's where the real desire comes in, for things in the mind that which then come out through action. So you're going through several layers here. Yes.
Can you just say a bit more about the intention to feel something? To me, that it happens so quickly, I'm not sure. You said those two things come together.
The fact that you have experienced a feeling, and this is what the concentration is designed to do, is to get you more still so you can actually see, oh, there is that element of intention that's coming up.
I still don't. Can you give an example? Or?
This is getting at a very, very subtle level.
Well,
but
that's maybe
yeah. Yeah. Because at the beginning, you just see it, the fact that the feeling is there.
Yeah.
And you say, well, at least I saw it while it was there. Yeah. And that's an accomplishment. And the next thing is to say, okay, can I see the stages leading up to this?
The intention
that goes into putting the mind on some object, one object rather than another. That's what it comes down to. Because there's the potential for all kinds of feelings in your body at any time. And they remain kind of just left at a potential level until you focus in. And then you've made it into an actual feeling. Like you're going to be sitting here and decide, I'm going to focus on all the pains. And you'll find there are a lot of pains. Yeah. Or you can say, well, let's focus instead on the level where there's pleasure. And the pains will just kind of go back into the background. So that's one level in which your intention has already shaped what you're going to be experiencing. Yes.
I just had a question about the preceding sutta, or the book number four,
mm-hmm.
where it says, I will touch
Okay, release has two levels of meaning. There's kind of mundane release when you've had something that's been weighing the mind down and you finally get released from it. Okay, and there's a sense of calm that comes from that. Okay, that is one level of touching through release when you've been able to let go of a particular obsession. And immediately there's a sense of release that comes in the mind. Then, of course, there's what we call noble release, when you've actually gotten to something that's deathless, as when you finally let go of some very, very subtle things in the mind as well. But again, in each case, it's touching it. You're actually directly experiencing it. The Buddha has, sometimes he'll talk about touching release through the body or seeing release through the body. In other words, it's going to be felt right here. It's not just a mental kind of thing, but you actually where you're experiencing the body right now is where you're going to experience total release eventually. Mm-hmm. Yes?
May I ask you to kind of give us an overview? The way that the study guide was sent out, we have four mindfulness with jhana. Mm-hmm. Samatha, vipassana, and jhana, discernment. Are these four levels of intensity, or is it just different aspects?
Different aspects. Basically, one is getting clear about what mindfulness is, and the second one is showing the relationship of mindfulness to jhana practice, to kind of erase the line that's dividing those, that tends to divide those two in a lot of people's minds. And then go back to erase another line, which is the line between samatha and vipassana, which again is, there's a common belief that there are two separate kinds of meditation, where actually there are two qualities of mind that have to be brought together in the practice of jhana and of mindfulness. And then the final one deals with the question, okay, once you've developed mindfulness and concentration together, how does discernment arise? So that there is that final progression there, yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't start with the overview. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now we have a couple passages on ardency. Mahagasava, how is one ardent? There's a case where, I'll just say you, thinking unarisen evils, unskillful qualities arising in me would lead to what is unbeneficial, so you arouse ardency. Thinking arisen evil, unskillful qualities not being abandoned in me would lead to what is unbeneficial, you arouse ardency. Unarisen skillful qualities not arising in me would lead to what is unbeneficial, so you arouse ardency. Or arisen skillful qualities ceasing in me would lead to what is unbeneficial, you arouse ardency. This is how you're ardent. In other words, this is a faculty of right effort. And it's right effort driven by heedfulness, realizing if I don't do this, there's going to be trouble down the line. So I've got to work on this. When you look at the definitions of the last three factors of the path, you have right effort, and then there's right mindfulness and right concentration. And the definitions of each factor tend to include the ones before. So here you've got right effort, and then you've got the ardency, and right mindfulness gets included in right mindfulness. And then the practice of right mindfulness gets included in the practice of right concentration. So you're kind of building around this kernel. And the kernel here is this realization, I've got to get my act together. I just can't let things arise and pass away. If it's something unskillful, I've got to do something about it. If it's something skillful, I've got to learn how to maintain it. And that's what drives the ardency. Similarly, if while you're walking there arises in a monk a thought of sensuality, a thought of ill will, or a thought of harmfulness, and you quickly abandon, dispel, demolish, and wipe out that thought out of existence, then when you're walking that way, you're said to be walking with ardency and compunction. You're called continually and continuously resolute, one with persistence aroused. So again, the ardency faculty here is the effort. That basically comes under right effort. And as I said earlier, there's an element of the wisdom faculty here, and that you sense, you basically distinguish what's skillful, what's unskillful. If it's unskillful, what do I do? If it's unskillful, what do I do with it? If it is skillful, If it's not there yet, what do I do to give rise to something skillful? All of that is the discernment, because it's discerning in the sense that I want to make sure my activities lead to something good in the future. So what you've got here is three qualities. You've got mindfulness that leads a little bit back into the past. Alertness focuses on the present, and then ardency is shaping the present for the sake of the future. You've got all three time frames brought together right here. Realizing it's not just things arising and passing away in the present moment. When they arise and pass away, they will have implications further on. And so you remember from the past, okay, I did X in the past, and this is what led to trouble, so I got to make sure I don't do that again, or vice versa. This is what worked, kind of keep working at it. When we talk about right effort, the element of discernment in right effort basically comes down to three things. It starts with the fact of what they call generating desire, which is part of the definition of right effort. You generate desire, uphold your intent. Okay. In other words, you learn how to motivate yourself to do what is right. And that really depends on what's going to work with you. Sometimes just thinking about questions of heedfulness, the fact that if I don't get my act together, I'm going to be like those people wandering around in the old folks' home. That's enough to say, look, I don't want to be like that. Or if I am like that, I want to at least have my act together. And so that's one way of getting yourself out of bed on a cold, foggy Victoria morning and saying, okay, I've got to meditate regardless. Other times you say, this is out of compassion for myself, or this is out of compassion for others. There's an element of shame. Here I've been meditating all those years and I still can't get out of bed. Something's wrong. There's also the element of pride. The Buddha encourages you to have a skilled person's pride in your skill. Like, I've learned this. Okay, why am I not using it? Why am I not improving the skill? So you have to learn how to psych yourself out. What do you need right now to get yourself encouraged to practice? That's the first element of discernment that goes into right effort. It's basically psyching yourself out. The second element that goes into it is figuring out, okay, what is the type of effort that's involved right now? And this usually comes under the categories, the framework of the Four Noble Truths. You've got suffering, which has to be comprehended. The cause has to be abandoned. The cessation of suffering is something you want to realize, and the path is something you want to develop. So once you figured out what is situation you've got here right now, okay, what is the right thing to be doing given this situation? My teacher tells about that when he was young and he had a really bad headache, which he found out later was caused by problems with his kidneys. But the headache lasted for quite a long time, and it got to the point where he actually had to have people staying in his hut looking after him. Other younger monks were there looking after him. And one night he woke up in the middle of the night and all the monks who were supposed to be looking after him were sound asleep. The first thought that went through his mind is, well, who's looking after whom here? And then the second thought was, okay, well, as long as I'm up, I might as well meditate. So he meditated. And suddenly it occurred to him that for the months that he'd had that headache, he'd been trying to get rid of it. He said, wait a minute, that's the wrong duty. I should be trying to comprehend it. And so that's when he focused in on that. And he said his practice benefited greatly as a result. So once you've see the situation, the next question is, what do you do with it? There's a similar story from, there's a famous meditating monk in Bangkok, his name is Chokun Noh. He was doing walking meditation outside of his hut one night, and this young monk came running up and says, I'm just overcome with these worries. I can't stop thinking about them. And Chokun Noh looked at him and said, you're doing the wrong duty. And went back into his hut. Bangkok Zen, okay? And so, firstly, the young monk had just been studying about the Four Noble Truths and realized, oh, yeah, I've been developing worry when I should be developing the path. So that's the second element of discernment, and just figuring out, okay, what is the duty that's called for right now? And then the third element, which we'll be getting into with passage 8 here, is how much? How much effort is appropriate right now? And that's going to depend on two things. One is exactly how much strength do you have right now? What are you capable of? You're coming home from work at the end of a long day. It's not the time to sit down and say that I am going to sit down and I will not get up until I have achieved, you know, unexcelled awakening. That's that's pushing it too far, okay? You say, I'm going to sit down here and I'm going to make it through the hour. It's a little bit more appropriate for that situation. So what? How much energy do you have? And then the second one is, okay, what does this particular task call for? And this is where we get into passage number 8. How is striving fruitful? How is exertion fruitful? There's a case where when you are not loaded down, you do not load yourself down with pain, nor do you reject pleasure that accords with the Dharma, although you're not fixated on that pleasure. In other words, you're not putting yourself through torture just for the sake of torture, or pain just for the sake of pain. You discern that when I exert a fabrication against this cause of stress, then from the fabrication of exertion there is dispassion. When I look on with equanimity at that cause of stress, then from the development of equanimity there is dispassion. So you exert a fabrication against the cause of stress, the first one, and you look on with equanimity at the second one. So again, there are some things that will respond to equanimity, and others where you have, as he says, you have to exert a fabrication. Now, fabrication here has three meanings. There's what's called bodily fabrication, which is your breath. There's verbal fabrication, which is direct to thought and evaluation. In other words, the way you talk to yourself, the questions you ask yourself. And then finally, there's mental fabrication, which is feelings and perceptions. The bodily fabrication, with the breath being, this is the element that shapes your experience of the body. Verbal fabrication, when you think about something and comment on it or evaluate it, that's basically what's involved in talking to yourself. Now, in talking to yourself, you will use perceptions, words, images. And those things actually have a very strong effect on shaping your mind. You look at somebody and you see, you know, enemy. You're talking to your lizard brain at that point. And that's why it has such a huge impact on your mind. It's these fleeting images that go through the mind. Years back when I was a layperson, I was in Bangkok when The Exorcist came out. And the two things about watching The Exorcist in Bangkok. One is, and everybody in Bangkok laughed because it was such a lousy exorcist. He's such an amateur. I mean, you go like this with a cross. In Thailand, they're professionals. They get these spirits out, you know, no problem. What? Well, yeah. I mean, that's how you, if you don't believe in them, you can't do battle with them. Okay? But you also have to know, it's like dealing with snakes. Snakes have certain capabilities and other capabilities they don't have. They can't see you when you're sitting still. It's good to know. Because they all they can see is movement. Snakes, yes. And if you know that, you can live with snakes and you're not so freaked out by them. You know, I've had several cobras go past me in Thailand. And I just sat there very, very still. And they had no idea I was there. That was a good lesson to learn when someone told me about that. Otherwise, I would have freaked out and it probably would have bitten me. But and it's not like I was used to snakes. At any rate, seeing The Exorcist, there was this one... the one thing that unnerved me, and it was this one image of a skull that they flashed on the screen at one point in the movie. I don't know if you noticed that. It was one of those kind of subliminal things where it was just there for a split second. And it happened only once in the movie, as far as I know, and it unnerved me because it spoke right to the lizard brain. And so that's what we're talking about. We're talking about perceptions, that these flashing images. Now you stop that. You know? Yes. If you want this afternoon, I'll tell you about an exorcism I saw in Thailand. It was quite something. When we're talking about feeling and perception as fabrications, okay, there are these images that go through your mind, and you want to see them. What am I associating with this? Why is this working me up? And if you can catch, I've associated this with that particular image, you can unlearn that. You can You can disconnect the two when you consciously see it. And that's an important thing to know. Replace it with another fabrication. And I mean, this is how the Buddha's, one of the reasons why the Buddha teaches so much in analogies and images is he's trying to give you new perceptions to hold in mind. Like he says, when you see someone who's been really bad to you, you try to focus on the good part of what they've done. Now, for most of us, they say, why am I focusing on this person's good side when they've done all these horrible things? And the Buddha says, think of yourself as someone going through the desert. You're hot, trembling with thirst. You come across a little puddle of water and a cow footprint. Now, if you try to scoop it up, the water will get muddy. Now, what do? You get down on all fours and you slurp it up. Now, it doesn't look dignified, slurping up, but you need it. At that point, if you're taught, and so that's why you have to focus on the other person's good qualities, not because you're being kind to that person or you're just being overly generous to the person, but you need it. And if you hold that perception in mind, it's a lot easier to look at the person's good qualities. So it's the same with whenever anything else comes up in the mind like this, you say, okay, if it's not responding to observing, it's okay, what are the perceptions I'm holding in mind, and can I change those perceptions so that it's not having that impact on me? So that would be one example of exerting a fabrication. Another would be just talking to yourself in a different way about it. That would be verbal fabrication. The third one is, how am I breathing around this? Why don't I change the way I breathe? This is one of the reasons why we work through the tightness in the body, so that you can breathe in ways that even when someone is yelling at you, you can sit there and they don't have to know this. You're breathing nice and calm and letting it just go past. So it's dealing with some things like this, you really do have to change the way you fabricate around it in order to get past that problem. This is more severe. This is think skillful thoughts. Because your thinking is going to get in your trouble if you don't learn how to think more skillfully. Yes. That would be, yes. Right, in most situations, yeah. Because you've got this potential here, you might as well use it. You think of the mind as an active process rather than a passive observer. You've got this ability to shape your experience, so try to shape it in a direction where you are able to think more clearly and able to deal more with less a sense of hunger or less a sense of being threatened by something. You're coming from a position of strength. So given the fact that you've got these potentials in the body, take advantage of them.